Hello and welcome back to this mini-series of Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast. Now, last week we talked about women's health, and this week we're talking about fertility. We're with the usual productive group today, so I'm hoping this episode provides some fruitful conversation. She's got more facts about the ancient Romans than you could possibly conceive. Xenia's here to tell us about how ancient Rome aimed for or avoided pregnancy. Meg is here to correct myths about ancient Greece that have spawned over the years. Meanwhile, Barney is brooding over the nonsense you might have heard about the ancient Near East. I'm Flo, and I don't know much about the ancient world, but I'm expecting to learn a lot about ancient fertility with you, dear listener. Now, before we proceed, I'd like to say that the topics we cover in this mini-series might be considered sensitive. If you feel that the subject matter might be upsetting to you, we'd advise catching up with us again in Against the Law Season 6. And as a disclaimer, terminology we use in this series might be based on ancient assumptions about sex and gender, which could not align with modern standards or understanding. And it ought to go without saying, but please, please do not try any of the ancient methods of treating gynecological health, contraception, fertility boosters, pregnancy advice, or childbirth methods that we talk about in these episodes. Not only will they not work, but they could cause you serious harm. And with that out of the way, let's get ready to learn about today's topic. So, listeners, you join us for our second instalment in our gynecological mini-series. And today we're talking about fertility. We've started the process to birth a new podcast for you. And I'd like to start off, because I've got some questions about fertility, that in the modern world, you know, we still deal with fertility and infertility problems. And I kind of want to compare what was the purview on fertility in the ancient world. So I'm going to start with you, Barney. I don't often start with you, and I'm sorry about that. But again, you've got a lot to cover in the ancient world.
I feel like the times when I start is either where something's very, very ancient and it's appropriate to start with the ancient Near East, or it's a sort of pity like you've just taken there. We don't do the old sort of Rome, then Greece, then Barney. In this case, it's both, I think, because I'm going to be talking about some very, very ancient things.
Absolutely.
When we decided to talk about fertility for the second part of this mini-series, I realised that a fertility figurine is one of the, I think, most common like museum designations for little statuettes from the ancient Near East. And I'm talking like really, really old, so pre-textual archaeology, back when really what archaeologists are finding from modern day Iraq is bowls and these little figurines. And I like these figurines. There are so many, sorry, I'm talking very, very broadly at the moment about a general class of objects, but I like to think that there's a little decision tree that when an archaeology takes one of these little statuettes out of the ground and they want to identify what it is, and the tree goes something like this. Does it have breasts? Yes. Does it have a pubic area? Yes, then it's a fertility figurine.
By that logic, we're all, well, you're not Barney, but me, Xenia and Flo are all fertility figurines. It's kind of, it's worrying.
Absolutely.
Hang on. I have a second tree.
Okay, sorry.
Is it or does it have a giant penis?
So still, we're leaving you out of the mix there. Yeah. So it's just Flo's and
you.
So anything that has genitals is a fertility icon.
Well, it's just a trend that I've noticed. And obviously there are archaeological and anthropological arguments for these things being fertility figurines. And actually, earlier I saw on social media a listing for an auction for some, I think, 18th or 19th century Chinese snuff jars or pots, quite small little glass things. And they had sexual scenes engraved into the front of them. And they were described as erotic. But, you know, there was breasts and there was penises on these. And I don't know if they would be associated with fertility. I don't know if looking at boobies helps you enjoy your snuff more. But, you know, it certainly is a question of context, maybe, and you know, when and why people identify things as relating to fertility. And I think often not having any text to go alongside it and only being able to go on where it was dug up might be a factor.
I wonder, in a couple of hundred years, when they dig up those lighters where the lady's bra slips off when you tip them upside down or if you warm it up in your hand, they'll go, ah, this is a 21st century erotic lighter. This is a fertility lighter. As you can see, this lady's brassiere slips off and she bares her breasts. So in the 21st century, men who are having issues with their sexual lives would use these lighters for their cigarettes. Anyway.
When I was looking at archaeological objects for this episode, I noticed that a figure from an Assyrian fertility figure, which was terracotta, from a few thousand years later than the very, very ancient ones I was just describing, was also called a fertility figurine, but it was also described as mass-produced. And you could tell that because the terracotta and the clay with which it had been made was quite rough. It hadn't been refined in any way. So there was no interest in kind of getting out bits of, you know, reed or shell or animal or whatever that had still been in the clay. It was people just grabbing lumps of clay, putting them into a mold, basically, and then churning loads of these out. So the idea was that it was a sort of mass-produced votive for fertility. And that was much more convincing to me, you know, that people might, in the case that they were wanting to conceive or struggling to conceive, dedicate one of these little votive figurines in order to, you know, wish for better luck. And I think that when we're at this time in history, you know, the sort of the first and second millennium BC, then I think we can talk more confidently about how the people in the ancient Near East thought about fertility, because that's when we start to get all the texts about it. And that's when things get pretty juicy.
You can still get fertility figurines. I mean, I remember only a year ago that when I started looking at things like ovulation test strips, which is a very modern sort of fertility offering for your urine stream, my suggested adverts on things like Facebook started popping up with the, I can't remember her name, the Venus of...
Is it Willendorf?
The Venus of Willendorf, yes. So again, she's got very, very large breasts. She's got a big tummy. She's got a big pubic area. She's got a big bottom. And she's this lovely curvaceous girl boss who is a fertility icon. And I was being suggested things like aprons with her printed on or candles in the shape of her. And I find it really interesting that nowadays people have fertility icons that they might have at home.
Surely a candle would be kind of horrifying because she would melt down.
Right. So I see a lot of candles of women's torsos and I think they're decorative candles only.
Yeah, right. You wouldn't want to burn that.
It makes me a bit annoyed at the concept, really, because I think things that are functional should be functional. That is a massive segue, but I agree. But I like that in the modern world we have fertility symbols now that we might have at home, just as mass-produced as they might have been in ye olde world.
Do you think it could be argued that it's an erotic image?
It could be an erotic image. Again, the lines are blurred there.
Well, I did wonder when we were talking about this earlier if there might be some sort of spectrum of, you know, erotic to fertility, because they are ultimately related to the same act, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not all of us, but many of us have an innate drive to procreate.
Also, surely, like, eroticism in and of itself is, like, completely subjective. Like, some people probably find the NHS page for athlete's foot erotic. I don't want to hang out with them.
Oh my god, Meg!
Okay, that was an oddly specific example, but I don't want you to read anything into it. I'm just saying. But like, do you know what I mean? Something is erotic for someone everywhere.
We can hear you and we agree, but that was a weird place to take it. Come on.
I think it depends on if you like differentiate between sex for pleasure and sex for procreation.
Sure.
Which I think a lot of like societies in history have.
I think that's a really good point, Xenia, about sex for pleasure versus sex for procreation. And nowadays, if we want to have sex for pleasure, we've got lots of options. Most of them falls on the women. But in the ancient world, what options were there?
So I actually think I have a really good link here from what Barney was saying about the representations of fertility. This is like the inverse of that. So there's a plant which the Greeks called Silphion. Xenia, I think the Romans also used it. They called it like Silphium. So this was apparently like the best anti-fertility plant. It had conception inhibiting properties. And there have been some studies, I think, which have said that, you know, this kind of plant or similar things would actually work to some extent. Obviously not to the same extent that pill would or the implant would or whatever, but they do kind of work. And Sylphion was like massively in demand in ancient Greece. They loved it. And they were like, we need loads of this, which again suggests there's very much a conversation being had about contraception. But it would only grow in this place called Cyrene in North Africa. And Cyrene became really famous for it because they could grow it. And their coins had Sylphion on them. That was the sort of symbol of the city. And one of them actually has not just the plant, but the plant and then a woman sitting next to it. And she's sort of pointing at her genitals.
Whoa.
Yeah, isn't that cool? It's like a coin with like someone using contraception on it.
So I love that because we have on our banknotes and on some coins, you know, and stamps and things in the UK, we have lots of iconography related to Great British inventions and Great British inventors. And I think there's a really strong parallel there between this coin where they go, look at this that we produce. This lady's showing you how she uses it.
Yeah.
What a fantastic step forward for women's rights that backslid for the next few hundred years. Anyway.
Well, unfortunately, they might have backslid because the Romans made Sylphium extinct. They loved it so much. They ate it all.
So... if you'll excuse me for suggesting this, the Romans shagged a plant out of existence.
Yep.
Right.
Unfortunately so. The Romans just really didn't understand sustainability in any way, shape or form. By 54 AD, there was said to be a single stalk of Sylphium left, and that was presented to the Emperor Nero.
Good Lord.
Which is probably not the best idea anyone ever had.
imagine how much easier things would be if you could have a salad, a delicious Greek salad, or a chicken Caesar salad every day and know that you're protected.
On the salad thing, can I just jump in?
Oh, yeah.
There is potential evidence that the Greeks, in some of their sort of rituals, they might actually have drunk a kakeon, which I've mentioned before. It's like a mixture, a cocktail of things. And there is evidence that in these kakeon mixtures, sometimes they would put in plants that could act as contraceptives. And there are some suggestions, this is very, very speculative, so take it with a large pinch of salt, but there's some suggestion that they actually took, you know, would have the drink, take the contraception so that they could go to the ritual and, you know, have a great time, let loose, not worry about things. So that is that they're kind of doing the salad thing. The extent to which it worked is obviously debatable.
Wow. So the kikeon is the wine sort of cheese mixture
that
you tried for our alcohol episode at Christmas time.
The dirty pint.
The dirtiest of pints. Oh man, can you imagine? I will just like to clarify for listeners that in terms of sexual health, if you're taking any non-barrier method to prevent pregnancy, like kikeon before attending an orgy, that does not protect you against sexually transmitted infections. Please explore other avenues to protect against these. Just thought I'd do my bit there to make sure that we're making sure sexual health is priority there.
I think we might need like a blanket thing before this episode that like do not try this
at home.
Absolutely not. Especially not Pliny the Elder's solution.
Oh, what's Ooh. Pliny the Elder's solution?
So I have a lot of contraceptive methods that the Romans used, but honestly, the most disgusting one of all of them is Pliny. And he says to cut open a large hairy spider, pull out two worms that live inside the spider and tie them to yourself with deer hide. And apparently this is effective for a year.
Oh, it would be effective forever.
What other reasons?
If I found out someone had done this, there is zero chance that they're coming back to my bedroom. Do hairy spiders commonly just have worms inside them?
I don't know. How do you know? No one knows which spider he's talking about.
Listen, I know personally that you have a large hatred for Pliny the Younger, but can that not extend to Pliny the Elder as well?
I think it should now. I also have a hatred of spiders.
Yes, quite. So I presume that the tying to yourself would be tying to a gentleman's private part.
No, this is directed at women.
No!
Yeah. Of course it is.
This is like the coil or the thing that you put in your arm, the implant.
No.
But worms.
No.
Oh my God, I'm so glad I've moved past morning sickness. That's disgusting.
I'm so glad I was born in the previous entry. Oh my god.
I really thought I was going to be able to beat the dirty pint with silphium, but I think Xenia might have outdone it, and now mine seems a bit feeble by comparison. No,
Barney, honestly, I need some kind of tonic after that. So I'm in the ancient Near East. Put me in the right place in the right time and tell me what I can do to avoid pregnancy.
Well, I can give you a sort of a double whammy. So I can give you the tonic first, and you are correct. You're in the ancient Near East, where a Babylonian text mentions a plant called the plant of not giving birth.
Oh, does what it says on the tin. It's like in Germany, they call the pill anti-baby pillin.
The Germans and the Babylonians obviously have a lot in common.
Absolutely.
However, if you found yourself in ancient Egypt, you might be more on the cutting open spider and removing some worms from it. Because one of their contraceptive measures from the same papyrus that I mentioned last time, actually, the Kahun gynecological papyrus, would like you to procure crocodile dung and sour milk. Although there is a good against the law, because apparently in certain corners of the internet, people are suggesting that the crocodile dung should be inserted into the vagina.
What do you mean, certain corners of the internet?
That's like when it's memed on, shall we say. That's okay. How people repeat it. But the text itself doesn't actually say anything about insertion.
Meg, it's the same corner of the internet that has the NHS athlete's foot page bookmarked. I don't know if the microphone picked this up, but I genuinely gagged.
So it did, I heard it.
That's not good.
If you're enjoying the podcast so far, why not support us on Patreon? From as little as £2 a month, you'll get each episode a day early, plus all sorts of other bonus content. Just search Against the Law Podcast.
Right, before I collect some crocodile dung up, I genuinely nearly gagged again. I want to know more recipes, please. How else, dare I ask, might I prevent a pregnancy in the ancient world?
Well, the Romans can come to your rescue, Flo, because they've got so many solutions. Like our guy Serranus, who wrote those 4 volumes on gynecology that we mentioned last time, he has got tons. So you can do other herbal remedies, including quite a lot of herbs that are still around today. Pennyroyal, but that has really quite nasty side effects. I think that's mentioned in Aristophanes as well. Balsam, a plant called the squirting cucumber. Sage, apparently.
Wait. The squirting cucumber, sorry.
Yeah, I just looked it up.
Can I guess? They reproduce by explosively squirting out seeds.
Yeah, hang on. Here we go. There's a YouTube video.
Don't click.
Xenia.
Oh, oh, no. No, it's definitely the plant.
I'm going to Google it. Anyway, it does. It explodes. It explodes to flower.
Its fruits
to spread its seed.
Oh, my God.
I saw some of these in Greece, actually.
Oh, wow.
Did any jizz on you?
The guy that we were interviewing, who was an ancient mining expert, started rummaging around in the bushes and then said, come and look at this, and just started kicking them as they all squirted all over them.
Come on, hear ye. Squirting cucumbers.
So alternatives, if you don't want to go foraging, you can put olive oil or honey around your vagina before sex. Just FYI, listeners, that won't work. Mm-hmm. He also suggests a vinegar douche post-coitus.
Ooh.
Which would sting.
Oh my god.
It might work a little bit because acid or acidic environments do kill sperm. They are spermicidal. But yeah, that's not nice. You can also plug the vagina with wool. Not very hygienic.
No.
He also advises putting maybe a bit of lead on that wool, which would lead to lead poisoning and have a contraceptive or abortive effect. But like, again, really bad idea to put lead anywhere on your body.
Very bad.
Lead poisoning, yeah.
And probably the most practical, or just kind of, you know, least dangerous method in terms of putting stuff around your private parts that shouldn't be there, is just squatting and sneezing after sex. So as to eject the sperm. But just FYI, guys, that does not prevent pregnancy either.
No. None of these would work.
None of these.
Pregnancy. Some of these could actually end your life. The wool in particular makes me think of toxic shock syndrome, which is a risk for anybody who uses tampons, for example. Mm. So please do not try that with or without lead, which I can imagine could cause some long-term damage.
Mm. Funnily enough, this is one of the attempted explanations for Roman general infertility, is lead poisoning, because they also use lead to line their water pipes. It's possible. Romans were kind of weirdly infertile as a bunch, like given the amount of sex that they had and given that these contraceptive methods like don't work. It is a little odd, but no one really knows why.
Interesting.
I have to say none of those do appeal to me. One of the herbs that you mentioned there was pennyroyal, which I've only learned about recently from a YouTuber, fantastic YouTuber called Max Miller, who does a series called Tasting History. And he does these fantastic recipes plucked straight from history. And the most recent one I've watched was a recipe that he's taken from Lupercalia, which is a festival that Zenny, you've mentioned before. And it involves goat or lamb with honey and garum, which we've talked about before, this fish sauce that sounds particularly unappealing. And but Lupercalia is a festival that's quite renowned for being related to intercourse, isn't it, Zenya?
It is, yeah. So it takes place in February, and it's at the Lupercal, which is a grotto at the foot of the Palatine Hill. And it's supposed to be where Romulus and Remus were suckled by a she-wolf. So lupus is wolf in Latin. Lupercalia is like a wolf festival. And there were priests. All of these priests were kind of young men who from the Roman nobility. They were priests of Lupercus, who's a fertility god. And what they would do at the Lupercalia is they would strip naked. They would sacrifice some goats. They would wear the skins of the goats. And then they would run around whipping any women that they met with the strips of the goat skin to promote fertility and childbirth.
Oh.
So that's the aim of it.
That's
I don't
really
love the whipping.
What I find attractive. No.
Well, well, it depends what you're into, but...
Oh, that's true. athlete's foot.
Sorry. Yeah, no, each to their own. Yeah.
Crocodile gun.
One famous priest of Lupercal is Mark Antony.
Oh.
Oh.
J-Lo's ex.
What?
J-Lo dated a man called Mark Antony. I don't know. It's
really?
Just come up in another podcast. Yeah.
That's really funny. He got around.
Absolutely. He's still getting around.
Oh my gosh. Is J-Lo the new Cleopatra?
Could be.
Oh my God.
So this was to promote procreation then?
Yeah, this was to promote fertility.
Do you know what? We've had loads of contraceptive methods. Crocodile dung, wool with lead embedded in it, cutting open spot. I can't carry on. I'll be sick. Do we have any methodologies of promoting fertility that might be in the lotion and potion arena?
Yes. Ooh. So many. So the Greeks are just obsessed with how to promote fertility. There's loads of lotions and potions. I also want to just add that the Hippocratic corpus, which I've mentioned in the last episode and previously, which is this kind of really important corpus of medical texts from like the 5th century BC, says that in order to get pregnant, this is how you should have sex. Okay, so the woman should be fasting. She shouldn't have eaten. The man should be sober, and they should both have just had a cold bath.
So you're hungry. Your partner's sober and you're both cold from the women's perspective.
You're both freezing.
I mean, I can kind of understand it. Maybe you want to warm up, distract yourself from the hunger, distract yourself from sobriety.
Yeah. So, how to get pregnant. First of all, you're going to need some boiled pine twigs, some white wine, celery, cumin seed, frankincense, and obviously boiled puppy and octopus. That's just a no-brainer.
Sorry, did you say puppy?
I did say puppy, yeah. I think that's specified.
No.
Okay.
I was with you all along that. I was thinking, do you know what? I consider the pine needles. I consider smelling like a car air freshener. Do you know what? Samuel Pepys mentions this. In Samuel Pepys's diary, his wife, they suffer from serious fertility issues, probably stemming from the fact that Samuel Pepys had a huge stone removed from his bladder on his aunt's or his cousin's table. So that might be why they couldn't have children. But she took it upon herself to solve the issue by putting what was called puppy dog water on her face. Puppy dog water isn't water boiled with a puppy inside it. It's the urination of a young dog. So this weird idea about puppies being involved in fertility is happening up to Samuel Pepys's day.
Christmas with the Pepys sounds absolutely awful.
It does sound terrible.
Samuel's on his aunt's table getting his bladder stones out. His wife's there holding a dog aloft, just weeing on her face.
On her face. So boiled puppy, boiled octopus, that takes that off the list for me. I think that's a bit extreme.
Yeah. I've got one more for you if you'd like it. This is specifically if you want a son. Well, if you're the man and you want a son, you should have vigorous sex with your wife just after her period has ended, which I think links to something we spoke about last episode about kind of at what point you're fertile in your cycle. But crucially, you've got to do it with your left testicle bound up, really bound up in...
The Romans did this as well.
Really? What? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, if they didn't want a girl, they had to tie off their left testicle.
Yeah, so this is a whole thing. If you want a girl, you bind the right testicle and you have sex while your wife is on her period.
What about if you tied up both testicles?
Oh my god. Oh, Barney, you've cracked the whole thing wide open.
Barney, in the ancient Near East, does any of the responsibility fall on men to improve their fertility or infertility?
Well, funny you should ask, Flo, because those old Mesopotamians were actually quite interested in male potency, so much so that there was a collection of texts, Babylonian medical texts, as ever, dedicated to what they called Nish Libi, which translates directly as the lifting of the heart.
Oh, that's quite sweet.
Of the heart.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I think Xenia might have cottoned on here. heart might have been a bit of a euphemism in this particular usage.
Oh, God, I'm so naive. Can you imagine a Babylonian chatting me up saying, I'll give you my heart, darling? And I go, aw.
You've given me a heart lift.
Yeah, that's really nice. You can have my number.
So, yeah, I mean, these texts were interested in the sort of loss of sexual desire in men. So not necessarily infertility, per se, but, you know, what we might call impotency. And there are some cracky examples, as we've been hearing throughout the episode, of ways that you might be able to cure somebody's sexual desire. I'm just going to go straight in with my favourite at the top. In translation, if a man loses his potency, try and crush a male bat that's ready to mate. Put it in water, which has sat out on the roof, and give it to him to drink.
So I have many questions. One of them is, how do you know that a male bat is ready to mate?
I guess you've given your female bat lots of aphrodisiacs.
Okay, there's quite a lot of prep that goes into this.
That's a lot of prep. I think I'd probably just say, not tonight, darling, I've got a headache.
Interestingly, they use quite a lot of metals to try and cure male potency. I don't know if that's a, like, if this was kind of modern marketing metaphors, it would be like, take steel X to rage like a bull.
Bring your steel beam to the front and center.
Exactly.
Bedroom.
Become Gerda.
That's definitely a meme.
So they mixed in iron powder.
The Greeks did that.
Oh, really?
Stones that attract iron were meant to be a fertility. Yeah.
Yeah, magnetite was the other one I had.
Very interesting.
There we go. But beyond these interesting and presumably to them somewhat logical remedies, there's also a focus in these texts that loss of sexual desire is not necessarily just a male problem. That might be the male partner who's sort of underperforming. And sometimes the sort of therapeutic focus is on both partners. And so there are prescriptions for certain ointments that you'd rub on the like genitals or the torsos or whatever of both sexual partners, which certainly led one commentator that I was looking at to suggest this was a very early form of couples therapy.
Oh, that's quite nice.
Couple massage.
Bat juices everywhere.
Yeah. I find it really interesting that the ancient Greeks and the Babylonians used iron because we do describe people as being magnetically attracted to him. I wonder if there's any evidence for or against iron as an enhancer.
Interestingly that you point that out, because I had another, you know, fertility promoting remedy, as it were, that's a very similar metaphor that we use in English today, and I assume in a lot of languages, actually. But one of the ways that a woman could get pregnant was by consuming a certain seed, the seed of a certain plant, that would then encourage her to take the seed. Mm,
it's a pun, basically.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of phallic foods that are considered aphrodisiacs, so you could consider that a metaphor for eat the seed to take the seed, eat the phallus to take... Yeah. Anyway, I'd like to move us on now to think about our favourite things that we've learnt today. I've learnt a lot. I've gagged a little. I've found some things endearing that possibly I shouldn't have done. The lifting of the heart springs to mind. And Barney, since I started with you and I put you on the spot first, I'm going to do the same thing again. I'd like to hear your favourite thing that you've learnt today.
Okay, thank you, Flo. So I'm going to be a little restrained here and not take any of the crazy recipes, ointments or whatever for promoting or preventing fertility or pregnancy. Because I'm a sucker for coins, I will go for Meg's North African coin from Cyrene with the silphium plant and the lady pointing at her crotch.
That would have been mine.
No way.
Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic.
I thought I was being charitable.
What, charitable with your coins? I just love it. I love it as a parallel to the modern world, that we are very proud of things and we put them on our currency. Meg, I'm going straight over to you because you provided the coin story. Tell us, what's your favourite thing you've learnt today?
I think that was charitable, Barney, but also, you know, thank you. I'm going to be really basic. My favourite thing was obviously the spider with the worms in it. That was hilarious and horrible. I'm obsessed with it.
I want you to answer for your crimes, Xenia. What was your favourite thing that you've learnt today?
My favourite thing was Barney's couples therapy.
Yeah.
I love that. I just love that at least one society in the ancient world takes joint responsibility for fertility.
I have to say, I've loved every bit of this episode. If I can't have the coin, I've loved every bit of this episode. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I'm so glad that I don't have to rely on any of the contraceptive or fertility boosting methods that we've learnt about today. So we're well on the way to conceiving our mini series baby. You can join us next episode to find out what happens next.